105.1 The Buzz. Daria's Entertainment Guide.
So this was requested, this guide, by someone whose screen name seems to indicate that she would be of the type of person described in the story, and also based on information given of the age of the story. And I hope that that is, in fact, the case. It is difficult to be a goth kid under almost any circumstances, the possible exception being a midnight screening of either The Crow or the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But when you're quite literally the only goth kid in town, and you're 16, 17 years old, life can be abysmal, torturous, just this side of unbearable. Luckily, you're goth, so maybe you prefer things that way anyway. I don't know. This was the case with Derek. Derek was in drama, and he was a dedicated and talented actor, but very difficult to cast if the play in question didn't revolve around the subject of, say, vampires. Musical or romantic comedy was pretty much out of the question, fitting his personality and mindset and appearance. So a lot of the time, Derek was regulated to behind-the-scenes work. Stage manager, lighting, generally things involving hiding back in the folded shadows of the curtain or watching the bright action unfold from above, lurking on the catwalk. Luckily, being goth, Derek preferred to be in those locations anyway. But everything changed junior year when a new crop of sophomores came in, and one of them was Tabitha. Tabitha was new not only to the school but also to the town. Her family had moved from Michigan the previous summer. Tabitha was not goth exactly, but she was very pale. She wore a great deal more black than was usual to see in our hallways in the mid to late 80s, and she had a name like Tabitha. Plus, she had a lip and a nose ring, plus earrings all the way around the outside rim of her ears. Adornments that were, at that time in that place, as exotic to the rest of the student body as a lip plate or a bone through the nose. The yearbook actually devoted an entire section to her at the end of the year. Anyway, she had taken drama at her old school. So even though the upper-level drama classes were supposed to be just for juniors and seniors, Tabitha, or her parents, worked out a special deal where she would be allowed in. And one or two days into the year, she showed up at the drama class door, books in her arms, lip, nose, and earrings flashing silver, and handed a note explaining the situation to our horrific nightmare of a drama teacher, Mr. James R. Coburn. He always introduced himself this way so that you wouldn't confuse him with the established Equity stage and screen actor James Coburn, like there was any chance in hell of that ever happening. Tabitha leaned against the doorframe as Mr. James R. Coburn read the note, and she scanned the room with a disaffected confidence that no underclassman was ever supposed to have. "Well then," said Mr. James R. Coburn brightly, handing Tabitha back her note and waving his hand in a grand gesture toward the classroom at large. Mr. James R. Coburn rarely made any gestures that were not grand. "Please take a seat anywhere. Class," he said, "this is Tabitha. Please make her feel welcome." He turned back to Tabitha. "May we call you Tabby?" he asked, tilting his head to the side and then covering his mouth with his hand in a "look how charming and silly I am" maneuver. "No, I wouldn't recommend it, Jimmy," said Tabitha, without even looking at him, and then took a seat right in the front. Most of the class gave an appreciative snort, and Mr. James R. Coburn laughed far too hard for far too long to show he was cool with it. But from Derek, in the farthest corner, clear in the back, there was silence. His subtly blacked eye-lined gaze was riveted on the back of Tabitha's head, his mouth slightly open. Derek could not have been more obviously in love at first sight if he'd had little hearts shooting out of his eyes and circling in a halo around his head like in a cartoon. Although with Derek, they would have been hearts pierced with daggers, affixed to wrought iron crosses. The point was, Derek was a goner. And the only thing more tragic than being the town's only goth teenager is being the town's only goth teenager in the full throes of unrequited passion. Except that it maybe wasn't entirely unrequited. Derek pined silently for the entire first half of the year, staring wistfully at the back of Tabitha's head, and doubtlessly filling entire spiral notebooks at home with great sprawling volumes of poetry. Then, just before Christmas break, Mr. James R. Coburn divided the class up into pairs to choose a non-theatrical work, extract the dialogue, and turn it into a two-person scene, and then present it to the class. Fate inserted her black lace fingerless glove, and Tabitha and Derek were paired up together. Derek looked like he was about to pass out from the news. Luckily, Derek, being goth, always kind of looked like he was on the verge of passing out. Tabitha moved to the back and turned her desk around so it was facing him. She tapped her black polished fingernail against her lip ring as Derek stared at his desktop and got more color in his cheeks than had ever been there in his life. "I was thinking," said Tabitha, "you and I could do a scene between Louis and Claudia from Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire." Said Derek, and boom, they were in love. For the next few months, Derek and Tabitha drifted through the days in a sort of black gauze love cocoon, sitting off during lunch to sit in the neighboring cemetery and stare desperately into each other's eyes, standing as close together as humanly possible, eyes closed in ecstasy and barely moving during winter formal, all in black velvet on an almost entirely deserted dance floor as The Caterpillar by The Cure played, or Friday I'm in Love by The Cure played, or Love Song by The Cure played, sharing black eyeliner. Then came the approach of Valentine's Day. Normally, Derek probably would have been one to dismiss the Valentine's holiday due to its commercialism and popularity and superficiality and association with stupid jocks giving their girlfriends ugly white and red carnation bouquets with the promise of awkward, unsatisfying backseat loving in exchange. But as it happened that year in English class, the hippest of all teachers, Mr. DeBotany, related the legend of St. Valentine, which set Derek in particular to a whole different path of perspective on the tradition. In the 3rd century AD, the Emperor of Rome ordered all citizens to worship the idols of the state religion, and to be Christian or to associate with Christians was an offense punishable by death. Valentinus was a Christian that stuck to his beliefs, and so, like the ostracized Goth, was shunned, berated, and placed in a dark dungeon of despair, though not yet an actual dungeon. Valentinus, of course, was near to the dungeon. One day, one of the Roman emperor's guards came to Valentinus, holding in his arms his daughter Julia, who had been blind since birth. Having heard that Valentinus was a healing holy man, he asked if there was anything that he might do for his daughter. Valentinus made ointments for the girl's eyes and had her return for frequent visits. Over the course of these visits, he taught her the history of Rome and also the nature of prayer. And though she could not see still, he taught her to envision the world through his eyes and his words. He also taught her math, which was nice or evil, decide amongst yourselves. Julia could still not see, but as a result of her weeks with Valentinus, she grew happy, educated, and gained a perspective of the world that almost all sighted women of the time could not begin to imagine. But word got back to the Emperor of Rome about Valentinus, and he was captured and imprisoned, this time in an actual dark dungeon of despair. The guard, whose daughter he had befriended, feared for his own life and that of his family, so though he had grown to love Valentinus, there was nothing he could do. As punishment for his association with Valentinus, he was made Valentinus's jailer. On the last night of his life, Valentinus asked his jailer for ink, a quill, and paper. His request granted, he wrote a note to Julia saying goodbye, urging her to remember all that he had told her, to keep believing in miracles, and he signed the letter, "From your Valentine." The next morning, February 14th, 270, Valentine was put to death. The grieving jailer went home and gave the note to his blind daughter. Julia felt something inside the note, opened the note, and a yellow spring crocus fell out into her hand. As it did, her eyes focused on it, and she saw color for the first time, and by the time she finished the letter, her eyesight had been perfectly restored. Julia went to Valentinus's grave and planted a pink blossoming almond tree in love and memory for her friend and teacher. 2 1/4 centuries later, the Pope declared February 14th, St. Valentine's Day, a day to stand for love, friendship, and affection, and abiding devotion. Now, maybe it was the goth-nip appeal of the combination of love, death, and desolate, pining, martyred beauty that so struck a chord with Derek. Or maybe it was because the Roman emperor of the story was Claudius II, who was known more completely as Claudius Gothicus. Derek was determined he had to do something spectacular and significant for the love of his life and beyond this particular Valentine's Day, something that would truly indicate the depths of his devotion to her, something that showed he would give up the very blood that ran through his veins for love of her, something maybe that literally included the very blood that ran in his veins. Now, letter written in blood or vial of blood to be worn as a pendant on a necklace were the two most obvious choices Derek's friends pointed out to him. But to Derek, these were too obvious. Also too predictable and overdone. Dozens of possible blood-based options were suggested and debated. Among the options were white silk roses soaked in his blood, chocolate-covered cherries with the cherry liquid extracted and his blood injected in its place, glass-blown candles with his blood mixed in with the wick-burning oil. The last one of those, the glass-blown candles with blood in the oil, appealed the most to Derek. It was almost right. It was close to what he wanted, and it finally served as the inspiration to what he finally came up with, blood lava lamp. Now, all he had to do was figure out how to make a lava lamp and learn how to bleed profusely. After several massively unsuccessful attempts, Derek consulted the enchantingly eccentric advanced placement chemistry teacher, Mr. Harlan, leaving out a few details about his plan, most key being, oh, and it will contain my own blood. Mr. Harlan was delighted by the challenge and consulted his colleagues, who came up with the following recipe for Derek. Colleagues, by the way, I should point out, is an old-fashioned word that today we call the internet. In an empty, cleaned liquor bottle, pour mineral oil into which has been mixed a small amount of minced permanent marker pen.
Or blood.
Take one part 90% isopropyl alcohol and two parts rubbing alcohol. Add the first over the mineral oil mixture, then pour the second into the first slowly. Then add a few drops of antifreeze and a few drops of liquid soap. Situate the bottle over a 40-watt bulb. Now, as he had not asked, Derek wasn't sure whether he should attempt to mix his blood in with the lava part or with the fluid surrounding the lava part. So he decided he would try both and see which worked. Either way, a lot of blood was going to be required. Somehow Derek, in all his planning, hadn't really given much thought to how he would actually extract the blood. Jabbing a needle into his finger, even over and over and over and over again, barely produced a teaspoonful. Nosebleeds just didn't seem to occur when you wanted them to. Actual vein opening, the serious stuff, while it worked in poetry, was just too daunting a prospect to carry over into reality. But just as love had walked into his life down the hallowed halls of high school, so did the solution to his problem. The February blood drive. Medical technology would do the job for him. It was perfect. The blood drive was promoted during health and gym classes, and the Red Cross volunteers arrived and set up in the ROTC room one gray mid-morning in early February. All participating students were to file through during their health or gym classes, and almost every student participated, as it meant getting out of health or gym class. I had health with Derek. I knew of his plan and was dying to see how he was going to carry out the task. I got on the reclining table, and when it was my turn, filled out the questionnaire, watched as the needle was inserted into my arm, and then saw Derek, just three chairs down, assuming the position himself. Then I turned and watched the stream of blackish-red fluid leaving my arm and traveling up the tube. That's about the time my eyes went like Julia's in 270 AD, and I passed the hell out, waking up 15 minutes later flat on my back in a wrestling mat in the corner, my legs elevated above my head and several anxious volunteers offering me Fig Newtons and orange juice, while my so-called friends in the background laughed their asses off and even pointed. Derek was gone, and so was his bag of donated blood. My sissy faint had provided him with the exact opportunity he needed to grab his own plastic-contained donation and slip away without anyone noticing. It was my own personal Valentine sacrifice. And did I get thanked? Did I get sainthood bestowed? No, I got Fig Newtons. Okay, I also got to see the completed blood lava lamp, which was completely awesome in a really sick, upsetting, disturbing type of way. It was just the sort of thing you'd want to stare at while listening to The Cure. This is your local entertainment guide on 105.1 The Buzz.